This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Bette Midler has a new album. It's called Bette Midler Sings the Rosemary Clooney Songbook, and it reunites her with her first musical director, Barry Manilow. He co-produced the album and performs on this track with Bette.
Hey, nice piano playing, Manila.
Thank you, Miss M.
What you doing these days?
Making records.
Really?
Yes, really.
Do you still play piano for people?
Well, depends on who.
I'm gonna get you on a slow boat to China. Walk to myself alone. Get you and keep you in my arms evermore. Leave all the others waiting on a faraway shore. Out on the briny, where the moon's big and shiny, melting your heart of stone. I'm gonna get you on a slow boat to China, all to myself alone.
Bette, I didn't know you felt that way about me.
I don't. I need a piano player.
Ah, just like the old days.
You're not going to change keys on me, are you?
Bette Midler made her first recording in 1972. Her first film was the 1979 movie The Rose. Her other films include Down and Out in Beverly Hills, Beaches, Scenes from a Mall, Get Shorty, and The First Wives Club. Terry spoke to Midler in 1998 after the release of her album Bathhouse Betty, which features songs that remind her of the ones she sang early in her career when she used to perform in a gay bathhouse in New York. Midler's family lived in Hawaii when she was a child. She told Terry about the neighborhood she grew up in.
You know what it was? It was a series of old barracks that had been used to house soldiers in the Second World War, and it had been converted to civilian housing. And it was, they were some of the apartments were one story, they were all wooden, and they had paper walls that were made actually of pressed cane. It was called canic, and you could sort of hear everything, you know, the walls didn't keep any sound out, and the neighborhood was plopped right in the middle of the cane fields. So there were cane fields all around. The dirt is very, very red. The sun is very bright. The sky is very blue. The sunsets were magnificent. The house itself was not anything to talk about, but the physical environment of the sky and the sea and the dirt and the green and the brilliance of the flowers, that really was astonishing.
Why and when did your parents move to Hawaii?
My father went to Hawaii when he was in the service in the 30s. And he liked it a lot, and he came back to New Jersey, where he was from, and married my mom, and they went out before the Second World War, and in fact, my mother was pregnant with my sister, my oldest sister, when Pearl Harbor happened, and they stayed through the war, and they only returned to New Jersey in the very early 50s, and I think they realized they didn't care for it anymore. They were happier in Hawaii, and they went back, and that's where they lived out their days.
You know, you always seemed so New York to me that when I learned that you were from Hawaii, I thought, no, that can't be.
Well, my parents actually made New York seem like the promised land. They talked a lot about it. They laughed about it. Their eyes lit up when they recalled their own childhoods in the East. And we all wanted to go there. My whole family, my sisters and I, we all wanted to go there. We thought, gosh, that must be so exciting. And in the end, we all did. As soon as my two sisters got out of college, they went. And I didn't spend very much time in college. I only spent about a year. And I came too. And I was instantly at home.
Well,
so maybe all that talk about it was helpful.
Well, before you got to New York, did you feel at all like you were in the wrong place as, a member of a Jewish family who was originally from New Jersey?
Well, I did and I didn't. I did because we were the only white people in our neighborhood. White people are called Howleys, and they don't distinguish between people who are Jewish and people who are Christians. They don't even care. They don't care what religion you are. You're white. That's that. So we were a Howley family in the midst of a Polynesian and mixed Polynesian community. And in one way, I did feel quite like the outsider, because I was very interested. I love to read. I love to look at, to think about the theater. I loved the idea of show business. I loved all those things. And yet this environment, the natural environment, was so extraordinary that I was completely at home.
Did you have a flair for theater as a kid, for the theatrical? Did you dress theatrically or have big gestures or, you know, see life as theater?
Well, I did. Actually, I did. By the time I was in the sixth grade, I was calling people darling. I mean, I don't know where that came from. I really don't know where it came from. I spent a lot of time in the library. My parents used to park us at the public library, a huge building, at least I thought it was huge, in the middle of Honolulu, which is an extremely charming town with beautiful sort of Pacific Northwest architecture, lots of stone buildings with beautiful tile roofs. And my parents used to park us in either at the Y or at the public library at 8 o'clock in the morning, and they would come and get us at 4 every weekend of our lives for at least 10 years. So I used to wander the halls of the library, and I found the theater section when I was very young. And I would go and I would play records in the theater section. I would play shows, and I would look at magazines, and I would look at books on ballerinas and shows that they had done in New York. I was a little kid, so everything that I picked up had an enormous impact on me. And I wasn't sports-minded at all, although I have discovered very late in life that I am exceptionally strong. But I never got picked for any of the teams. And the big thing in our world was volleyball and softball and baseball and my community was very sports oriented, and I wasn't very sports minded. I was a bookworm.
It's interesting that the library played such a big part in interesting you in theater. I think you didn't get a telephone or a television until you were a teenager.
Just about. That's just about right. I was old. I was much older. I was something like 11 or 12, and consequently, I don't have the TV habit that people my age have. I'm not used to turning it on. I remember very vividly when we were children, we came to New Jersey and people had TVs, and it was a very big thing, and I didn't get it. I mean, I watched what was on it, and I didn't get it. I didn't understand the charm of what was on it, and I didn't know why anyone would sit and watch it. So I never really got the habit, even though eventually when I became a teenager, to see Elvis Presley was a joy, to see the Ed Sullivan Show was a joy. And those things I did get addicted to. But the general tenor of TV, I never got it.
You mentioned that you heard a lot of Broadway music in the library. Did you hear rhythm and blues or rock and roll when you were in Hawaii?
I remember very vividly when the first rock and roll song I ever heard, it was in the middle 50s, I think it was 55 or 56, and it was Ape Call. That was one. And then there was the one about the car. It was Nervous Norvis, I think, was making records, and Little Richard was making records. And those acts used to come to Hawaii. We had a terrific promoter there, and they all came through Hawaii. And I knew kids in the fifth and sixth grade who actually did get to go. I didn't get to go because I couldn't afford it. But the radio, there were a couple of really, really good radio stations there, and we heard it. And it was very, very exciting to us. Rhythm and blues I came to actually late in life, relatively late in life. When I came to New York, I met a couple of people who were just stone, hardcore rhythm and blues fanatics. And they started, we used to go home after our work, and they would play these records for me. And I was completely carried away by it. And it still remains my first love. When I think about pop music, I do love pop music, but my soul absolutely is stuck in rhythm and blues. And I shouldn't. I also should not forget that I'm also a Hawaiian music fanatic, which is something that people don't really know about me. That I'm attached to that music in a very visceral way. I guess because we had a hula teacher kind of close to our house, and my mom sent me to hula class for a couple of years. And I mean, I really didn't get the dancing. I wasn't particularly good at the dancing. But boy, did I love that music. See, Hawaiian music, there's a lot of yodeling in it. And I always used to say that the men sing high and the women sing low. That's not necessarily true. But the group of performers that I was brought up with were exceptional musicians. And that's one of the great joys of being in that part of the world. People love to sing, and they love to dance, and they love to have a good time.
Would you do some Hawaiian vocalization or sing a little bit of a Hawaiian song for us?
Oh. Ulili'e, ulili'ho'e, ulili'holo'holo'kaka'i'e, huia'ka'u'olana'mali'e. That's a very popular song. But there are others. I in the back of my mind, I've always thought, oh, one of these days I'm going to make a Hawaiian album. But I don't think I'm going to get around to it at the rate I'm going. I only make a record once every couple of years or so.
One of your big breaks when you came to New York was that you were, I think, first cast in the chorus of Fiddler on the Roof on Broadway, and then became one of the daughters in it. Which songs did you get to sing in Fiddler?
I sang Matchmaker, and I sang, I think that's the only song I had a solo in. In the chorus I sang Frumacera's part one time. That was a great song. How can you allow it? How can you let your daughter take my place? I always loved that, and I loved the costume. What a costume. That was a fabulous, fabulous score.
What did you learn about music and theater from the theater people who you hung out with while doing Fiddler on the Roof?
Well, actually, to tell you the truth, I learned more when I was in Hawaii in the community theater, because they are very actory in community theater. There, you know, I guess because it's not a professional environment, the idea that people from the community come and are stars in these plays, you get the most flamboyant people in the entire community. So that our community theater was a hotbed of the most flamboyant types you could possibly imagine. And so I was, in fact, when I got to New York, I was kind of let down, because we had real peacocks in our community theater, and they were definitely peahens in New York. They weren't as in love with it as they were in Hawaii. They were really swept up, carried away by show business in Hawaii, and not so much, really, when I got to New York.
Now, how did you end up from Fiddler on the Roof to singing in the baths to an audience of gay men?
Well, I worked in the Fiddler on the Roof for 3 years, and I was determined to get another job in another show, because I wanted the experience of other shows and playing other parts, of course. But I couldn't get another job. I was I went to auditions, and I had my 8x10s, and I had all my songs, you know, and I was prepared. And I got called back many times, but I never actually got another job. And I finally said, well, gee, I don't get this. This isn't really happening for me. And there was something else going on at the same time. It was the 60s, and there was madness in the streets, and music had completely turned over on its head. The Beatles and the Stones and rock and roll was crazy. And it seemed like the people that were my age, something was happening to them, and I wanted to be part of that. And it seemed like I couldn't be part of that in the theater. And so I looked around, and I was very lucky, because there was a girl who was in the show with me, and she said, oh, come on down to come downtown with me. We're singing. Everyone's going to sing a few songs in this club. So I said, well, sure. And I got my little bag with my little songs, and I went down with her, and I sang. I'll never forget it. I sat. The guy who played for that crowd of people was a brilliant, brilliant guy. His sight reading was impeccable. He could change a key whenever you wanted. And I sat down and I sang God Bless the Child. And something happened to me when I started singing that song. I suddenly was in another world. I was in a trance, and after that, there was no looking back. What had happened to me was so meaningful and so powerful that I realized right then that this is what I wanted to do. I wanted to be alone. I didn't want to have, you know, two scenes in a show. I wanted to be the show. And after that, I never looked back. I just went straight forward. I put one foot in front of the other, and now I wound up here with you, Terry.
And a lucky break.
I'm here with you, and I just, and this is where
the pinnacle
where
of your career.
All that work led to you.
Now we could just have the close credits and the end theme. So how did you actually get to the bath?
Well, I was I put together a few songs, and in those days there were many rooms in New York where you were allowed to sing to go from club to club. You could go from club to club, and you could sing three songs a night. So I had a little route that I took along with my friends, and we would go from 9th Street to 70th Street, and from 70th Street over to the East Side, and you would just make these little rounds. And depending on what time you got there, you would get to sing your three songs. And eventually I got more than three songs. I had maybe a repertoire of maybe 10 or 12 songs. And that's what's known as, you know, an act, at least an opening act. And I sort of settled in Bud's place, Bud Friedman's place. He had a place called the Improv on 44th. And it was a mix of singers and comics. And I was one of the more popular singers at that time, and I was still taking little classes here and there at HB Studio down in the Village, and this gentleman named Mr. Ostro called one of the teachers there and said, "Do you have anybody that can that has a little bit of an act? I need someone to come and work in my bathhouse." And the guy that he was speaking to was a teacher of mine, and he. He said, "Sure, I know someone," and he called me up and he said, "Look, this guy's going to call you, and you should be prepared. He needs a singer. He's willing to pay $300 a week, $300 for the two nights or whatever it was." And I said, "Where is it?" And he said, "Oh, it's in a gay bathhouse." And I said, "Oh, okay." And Stephen Ostro called me, and he told me what the situation was, and I went down, I looked at the place, I said, "Well, it looks perfectly fine to me." He had an excellent piano player, and he had an excellent drummer, and I did my, you know, we played, we rehearsed, and a week later I had opened, and there you go.
Could you give us a sense of what your persona was like at the bath, what you wore, what kind of patter you would do in between songs, the kind of jokes you would tell?
Well, it was the 60s, the very late 60s, maybe the early 70s. I was wearing a lot of vintage clothes because I loved vintage clothes, and my hair was very long and kind of frizzy, and they always put a backlight on me so that I looked like I had a halo. And the makeup was appalling, but there was a lot of it. And I always wanted to have a sort of a sexy appearance because I thought that was a fun thing to do. I enjoyed looking and creating that image. And you have to love the illusion. And indeed, I did fall in love with that illusion. And she was divine. Cause they started calling me divine. They asked me how I wanted to be introduced. And I told them the very first night, "You may call me divine. Tell them I'm divine." "Well, what's your name?" And I had a hairdresser who was a great friend of mine. His name was, we always called him Mr. G. His name was Bill Hennessy, but he went by the name Mr. Gerard when he was in the beauty salon, and they called him Mr. G. And he used to call me Miss M, and I called him Mr. G. And so I said, "Tell him I'm." They had heard me. Stephen Ostro heard me, heard Bill calling me Miss M. And so that's how it came about. He heard me. He said, "Miss M." And I said, "Tell him I'm divine." "No, the divine Miss M." And there it was. And it stayed with me. He liked saying it, and I liked being it. And so there we were.
But part of what you were making was this alter ego.
Yes, absolutely. And absolutely.
So you were consciously crafting an alter ego.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I still look on it as my greatest creation. I do.
How do you relate to
fabulous.
The alter ego? I mean, is
not at all. How do I relate? It depends on the day. You know, sometimes I'm mad about her, and sometimes I think, "Oh God, I'm so wiped out. I'm so tired. Why doesn't all this just go away?" So it depends.
Now, Barry Manilow became your pianist at the Baths in, I think, 1971. I think he was your second pianist there.
Was it 71? Yeah, I guess it was. Maybe it was 70. I think it might have been 70 because he was with me for 3 years, and I think he left in 73. So I think it would be 70, no?
So he was not a known songwriter when he joined you.
Well, he was known around town as a jingle writer. I think he had a deal with Bell Records before we met. So he was known. He was known around town. He was a highly, highly respected keyboard player and also a jingle writer.
Did he give you any suggestions of songs to add or things to do on stage?
We had a wonderful time together, but we were like an old married couple. The work was absolutely fantastic, but we bickered a lot. I was very cranky with him, and I think he was very cranky with me too, only because we both had very strong ideas, and there was a lot of push and pull there. But my memory of it was that the shows were fantastic and that we pretty much had a ball. We had a wonderful time. We went so far so fast. And I think both our heads are still swimming from it, to tell you the truth.
Do you want to choose a record that you recorded with Manilow at the piano?
I must say, he did his version of Do You Want to Dance really is fabulous. I love the way he played that.
Good.
I love the way he played that.
Let's hear that.
Do you want to dance and hold my hand? Tell me you're my lover man. Oh, baby. Do you want to
out of the Baths and started recording records and reaching a broader audience.
Thank God we're reaching a broader audience. I thought we'd never get out of the Baths.
Did you?
I thought we were going to be in the Baths for this whole interview.
Did you change your image at all or try new kinds of patter or new costumes or anything different on stage, new songs?
Well, I had a little bit more money to spend, so the costumes got a little better, looking, but they were basically in the same bad taste, which I think was part of the charm of the whole thing. I used to say, I realized at the time that people were just breaking out of the out of their 50s thought patterns and that bad taste actually could be a lot of fun. And so I never really actually gave that up. The patter got better. I met a lot of people. I hooked up with Bruce Valanche, who I still think is fabulous. He's a great guy. I met him in Chicago. He was writing for a Chicago paper, and he interviewed me. And we had so much fun that I asked him to write me a few lines, and he's been writing me a few lines ever since. So things did get better. I think I really did actually tone down when I a good deal when I I got tired. I was hospitalized a couple of times in the 70s for exhaustion. And I just got so tired of being on all the time. And I said, I don't really want to do this. I would rather just be who I am and not have the stress and the anxiety of being this character all the time.
Well, I guess I'm wondering, you know, if when there is that pressure of being a character all the time, do you start to feel bad that people don't like you for who you really are? They like
well,
you for
it does creation? Occur to you. Uh-huh. It does occur to you that maybe people aren't. It does occur to you. It definitely does. And even today, I'm not sure when I meet people. I always feel like I'm vaguely disappointing them because I'm smaller than they think I am, and I'm cuter than they think I am. They always say that. Oh, you're so short, and oh, you're much prettier in person. I'm saying to myself, who's lighting me that I look this bad? I look so bad that people have to tell me how much better I look in person. And I always think that I'm as I said earlier, I'm kind of a serious-minded person. I read the paper. I'm interested in the world. You know, I like nature in spite of what it did to me. You know, I mean, I'm trying to be a whole entire human being. I'm not trying to be just a caricature. So when they meet me and they want me to, you know, tell Sophie Tucker jokes or hum a few bars, I'm always appalled because I'm in show business. I get it. You're not the same. You are not that character that I saw you in that movie, you know, that you played in that movie. But I sometimes think that a lot of people think you are who, you know, you are that. And it kills me. It just kills me.
You know, in some ways, the way you described your alter ego, it sounds like you saw yourself as a performance artist, you know, who kind of crafts an alter ego like that. And your husband is a performance artist, too.
Yes, he is.
So I guess is that something you felt you had in common, that sense of alter ego?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we're very, very similar in temperament. We're both fairly serious-minded people, but this is a great outlet for us. You know, we get to act out. We get to be what we really aren't, you know? Come as you wish you were. You get to be all the things that you didn't get to be as a teenager, as a young kid. And it's a lot of fun. It's very therapeutic.
Bette Midler spoke with Terry in 1998. Midler's new CD is Bette Midler Sings the Rosemary Clooney Songbook.